541 in Lincoln and 77 degrees this afternoon on Drive Time Lincoln, 1400 KLIN. I'm Kevin Thomas. Glad you're with us today for a very busy day of DTL. In the last half hour, we had both of Nebraska's U.S. Senators, Senator Deb Fischer, Senator Ben Sass. If you missed either of those conversations, we'll get them podcasted, KLIN.com. You can listen to them both there. A little bit of a different conversation with each. One a little bit more about politics, the other one a little bit more about policy. And there is still another angle to cover the Supreme Court decision from today when they ruled 6-3 in favor of the subsidies for Obamacare, the federal health exchange subsidies for Obamacare. The state-based exchanges were never a question. This was whether or not the federal government had the authority to issue subsidies for states, including Nebraska, that were using the federal marketplace as opposed to the state-based exchange. And so the last aspect of this that I want to cover today is to get a constitutional perspective, because there's been a lot of talk about going forward what precedent today's decision, today's opinion may set, not just as it pertains to health care, but as it pertains to other court cases that come before the Supreme Court as well. And joining us this afternoon on Drive Time Lincoln to cover that aspect of this is UNL constitutional law professor Dr. Eric Berger, who's with us today on the Liberty First Credit Union Hotline. Dr. Berger, great to have you on Drive Time Lincoln this afternoon.
Thanks very much for having me.
I think the angle that I'd like to talk to you is going to be different than we talk to the senators, because they're talking about what comes next, what they have to do next, and what that all means. But I'd like you to dig into the opinions and just the whole theater of today at the U.S. Supreme Court. Let's start with a majority opinion from the Chief Justice. Are you surprised by some of the language he used that really says, and he said this apparently in the court today, that it was a very poorly written law, but they kind of got the gist, and so that's why they took the route they did with the ruling?
I'm actually not that surprised. I mean, you see the Supreme Court do that in other cases. I think the Chief Justice is right that it was a sloppily drafted law. It was obviously an extremely complicated law, and it was drafted hastily and under very unusual circumstances. So there are problems with it. But, you know, I think the major theme in the Chief Justice's opinion was, drafting statutes are hard. Congress doesn't do it perfectly. It certainly didn't do it perfectly here in the Affordable Care Act. But the court should try to interpret statutes so they make sense. The court, when it's presented with an act of Congress, shouldn't read a provision and say, gotcha, so that the whole law falls apart. It should try to effectuate Congress's goals and try to figure out what's the overall context of the law, what's Congress trying to accomplish, and what reading of this provision makes sense given everything else in the law, and that's a lot more respectful of elected officials than the court just trying to catch Congress with identify a drafting error and have the whole law sort of come crashing down because of it.
Now let's turn to the dissent, in particular from Justice Scalia, because this is the one that's being cited the most today. He uses terms like jiggery-pokery at times during this, but I think the thing that a lot of people are latching on to is this line. This court, however, includes that this limitation would prevent the rest of the act from working as well as hoped, so it rewrites the law to make tax credits available everywhere. We should start calling this law SCOTUS care. When you read something like that, after your interpretation of the majority opinion written by the Chief Justice, what's your reaction to Justice Scalia?
Well, I mean, this is a great case from a law professor's standpoint because it really pits two different approaches to statutory interpretation against each other. You know, I just summarized the Chief Justice's approach, which is essentially we should be respectful of Congress and try to interpret the law in a way that it makes sense, so that ambiguous provisions should be interpreted in the context of everything else. Justice Scalia here offers a very different approach where he says, Congress chose this language. It said the subsidies are available for people who buy insurance from an exchange established by the state. And the court is reading that language to mean an exchange established by the state or the federal government. And it's the court's job to follow the language that Congress enacts. And if Congress screws up the language, that's their fault. It's not ours, and it's not our job to clean up Congress's messes. You know, I'll point out that that basic fundamental dispute about how to interpret inartful statutory language is one that goes back for generations, really. So that the dispute today between the Chief Justice and Justice Scalia, even though it's getting a lot of attention because this is a very high-profile statute, but it really nicely crystallizes a dispute about what court's role should be when it's interpreting an act of Congress. Should it try to figure out what Congress wanted and interpret the statute in a way that makes sense given the rest of the statute and given Congress's goals, what Congress is trying to accomplish, or should it be more of a straightforward textualist and just say, we're going to interpret this language, and if it doesn't make sense given the rest of the law, that's not our problem, that's Congress's.
Do you share some level of apprehension about the future of rulings on something like this, as Justice Scalia does, that this is what was decided this time? Might this put in the hands of a future court some more level of interpretation when it comes to ambiguous language?
Well, you know, I think, you know, as an approach to statutory interpretation, what the majority did today is actually pretty consistent with what the court often does. It isn't what the court always does, but it's what it often does. And there are even cases where Justice Scalia himself has refused to apply the plain language of the statute because it would either lead to an absurd result or is a drafting error where Congress, you know, said one thing, but it clearly didn't mean to say what it meant to say. So, you know, I teach statutory interpretation, and one of the things I tell my students is that we're learning tools, not rules. So in other words, they're not ironclad rules to statutory interpretation. And I don't think there ever have been, and they never will be. I think the court does pay close attention to statutory language. I think even though Justice Scalia is upset that what he thought was the plain language here didn't guide the decision, I think the court is going to continue to pay close attention to statutory language, but it's going to do so in the context of the whole statute. And if a particular interpretation would make a mess of the rest of it, the court is going to question whether that interpretation is correct. So, you know, I think the general approach applied by the Chief Justice today is more or less consistent with how the court often thinks about these things, except for when it's not. And that's kind of the catch here, is that, you know, it really depends on which approach has five votes in a given case.
University of Nebraska constitutional law professor Dr. Eric Berger is with us here for just a couple more minutes on Drive Time Lincoln. There was an article in the New York Times, or as an editorial in the New York Times earlier this week, that's kind of been bouncing around as everybody's talking about the Supreme Court this week, that hypothesizes that the court has, even with five justices appointed by Republican presidents, has lurched left or moved left. Do you tend to look at this court as being a little more left than right, as the New York Times looked at it earlier this week?
No, I don't. I don't put too much stock in those kinds of studies. I mean, for one, it's just one term, and to get a real pulse of the court, you need to follow it over many terms. So, you know, it could be that just the decisions that came out this term, the law, you know, the justices thought the law required outcomes that the media perceived as being more liberal than conservative. But I don't think that really is enough to say that this court has lurched or moved to the left. Second, you know, while there's some decisions that seem clearly to be liberal or conservative and that are easily categorized, you know, one way or the other, there are a lot that cannot be categorized so easily. And yet people like to categorize them. And for this kind of a study, the people who engage in the study have to code them one way or another and, you know, decide this decision is liberal or this decision is conservative. And I haven't gone back and looked at the coding in that study, but I suspect that one could take issue with some of the coding. But a sort of more fundamental disagreement, which in a way gets to the point I made earlier, is that I think it misleads the American people into thinking that what the court does is primarily politics and not law. Hmm. As I said a moment ago, it's absolutely true that politics and values shape the way the justices think about issues and the way they see the law. So I certainly don't think that law is insulated from politics. And it's no accident that the Republican-appointed justices on certain kinds of issues tend to vote in a way that favors conservative outcomes, and the Democratic-appointed justices tend to vote in ways that favor liberal outcomes on certain issues. But I also think that the justices do try to follow the law, and that there's some cases where the law is clear, and they're all going to vote the same way, and they're not going to ask what's a liberal or a conservative answer here. They go with what the law requires. In close cases, the law is unclear, and that happens a lot in constitutional law. And I think in those cases, politics is going to affect how the justices interpret the law. But I think that's more of a subconscious thing. I think it shapes the way they think about precedent, the way they think about history, the way they think about text. In other words, I don't think the justices are getting a case and saying, all right, I really want to come out with a liberal outcome here, or I really want the conservative outcome here. Their approach, they're given a difficult legal question that has a lot of complicated evidence cutting both ways, and I think it's natural that their own sort of political biases are going to affect the way they filter through that complicated evidence, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, Dr. Berger, this is, I think we can keep going for a long time on this, but we're just about out of time this afternoon on Drive Time Lincoln. I do appreciate you sharing some perspective today on what was a very interesting day, some very interesting theater as well, and plenty of analysis afterwards. Thanks so much for joining us today on Drive Time Lincoln.
Oh, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate you having me.
UNL constitutional law professor Dr. Eric Berger with us today on Drive Time Lincoln on the Liberty First Credit Union Hotline. We still have a few minutes left of DTL running long today. It's been a busy hour with two U.S. senators and a con law professor. It's 553 and 78 degrees on 1400 KLIN.